The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Can a Russian, Turkish, and Iranian alliance restore peace to war-torn Syria? Well, the early signs are not good. Yesterday's assassination of a Russian ambassador to Turkey in a gallery in Ankara looks like a setback. Andrei Karlov had served for over 40 years as a diplomat for the Russian government. Karlov's assassin, who was killed by officers at the scene, was heard yelling first in Arabic, "God is great," and then in Turkish, "Don't forget Aleppo. Don't forget Syria." The Russian government has called this a terrorist attack, and President Vladimir Putin has said that the fight against terrorism will be ramped up. Borzudar Agahi is a Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News and joins me now from Istanbul. Borzu, where do we stand right now?
Well, I think that they're still trying to investigate and figure out who this assailant was, whether he had ties to any other groups, whether he was a lone wolf, self-radicalized, the same kind of questions you would ask after an apparent a terrorist attack in the West. But, you know, I mean, one thing that is clear is that there does seem to be, with the election of Trump, with the coming election of François Fillon in France, a sort of building consensus around what to do with Syria, which involves kind of rallying around, to a lesser extent or a more greater extent, the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And what happened last night sort of shows is that that's really not going to be a real solution, because the injustices perpetrated by the regime of Bashar al-Assad and the amount of blood spilled in this war are not going to just be swept under the rug, and they're going to be spilling over into other countries, other parts of the world for some time to come. And that was the sort of the first kind of frightening thought that I had when this happened, is that, you know, here are Russia and Turkey and Iran and even to some extent the U.S., and other allied countries kind of sort of coming together on a sort of threadbare solution for Syria. And here are the consequences, because that solution is just not going to resolve the underlying issues.
There were some talks on the future of Syria between Turkey, Iran, and Russian officials. Have they been canceled?
No, they have not. They've continued. I think of this as sort of a mini Yalta conference, where the kind of victors of the Aleppo-Syria conflict get together and sort of divvy up domains of influence ahead of the new U.S. president taking over. And, you know, you have three parties, each with very different interests when it comes to Syria, trying to not get in each other's way, trying to pursue their own goals without tripping each other up and risking any kind of escalation and so on. And that's how I see this very important meeting. And there was no reason to cancel it just because some career diplomat in the Russian Foreign Service was assassinated. Now, is Russia going to do something about this? I think absolutely. And I think that given Russia's track record, it will be out of proportion to what has happened. But I think that what they do ultimately, how they respond, will be contingent upon the investigation and what the investigation concludes, what kind of connections, if any, this man had to any other organizations and so on. And it should also be said that, you know, Turkey, when it comes to like Turkey, Russia, Iran, these are not countries that have like great track records when it comes to like rule of law and transparency and so on. So, you know, regardless of who this gentleman was, there's a great possibility that they'll make a very expedient decision as to who he was, one that will help them pursue their own interests rather than have anything to do with the truth necessarily.
Did this Russian diplomat, Andrei Karlov, have any political significance inside Russia, in that he might have challenged Vladimir Putin, anything like that?
I don't think so. I think I have not heard anything like that. I mean, he was just a career diplomat, and I've met, you know, quite a few career diplomats from the Russian Foreign Service over the years in the Middle East. These are, you know, real serious bureaucrats. They usually speak the language very well of the country they're working on. They're very quiet and discreet. They don't give a lot of press interviews. They're not flashy people. I don't get any sense that he had any kind of political role whatsoever. What I do hear, though, is that he was a key player in the Aleppo talks. He was playing a role in trying to resolve this issue as a negotiator, just a messenger, really. And from what I've heard from people who have been close to the negotiations, he was a pretty good guy and not a hardliner in the sense that he wanted to punish the Syrian people in any kind of vocal way.
Borzu Dargahi is a Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed, speaking to us from Istanbul. Thanks so much, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure.
To Berlin now, where on Monday evening a truck plowed into a Christmas market outside of the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church, killing at least 12 people, injuring dozens of others. The holiday spirit immediately dampened in a city full of questions about the future.
You know, this wouldn't have happened, you know, 10 years ago, and it could have happened, you know, since about a year ago in Germany. So it's I don't know if this is start of something, and Berlin is a very welcoming and a very liberal city, and it's a pity.
One voice there among people on the scene last night. Thalia Beattie is a freelance print and radio journalist in Berlin, also a Fulbright Journalism Fellow and a former Takeaway producer.
Well, last night, a large, like, 18-wheeler truck drove into a Christmas market that was located in basically the historic center of West Berlin, in front of this Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church. And 12 people were sort of killed immediately, and then 50 others about were injured. And some of them quite seriously. And so, of course, this is just a, you know, very disturbing attack on what is an important Christmas tradition here in Germany.
And people that you spoke with were on the scene very quickly, it sounds like.
Yeah, one man I spoke with is a Berliner, you know, with a classic accent. He had been at the market earlier that evening and had then come back through to find this destruction. Part of the side of the market just like torn to shreds.
Und unter diesem LKW,
and lying under the truck, there were at least four badly injured people just lying there. I tried a few things to help them, but you couldn't help them. They were really jammed in there.
What were people saying about theories about why this is happening now, whether this is a result of circumstances in the news right now? What are the theories?
When I spoke with people last night, it was about 10 or 11 p.m. here, you know, 2 hours after the attack, and there was no information about exactly what had happened. But the worst fear for everyone is that this is related to the arrival of people from, you know, Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan, you know, this wave of migrants that have come to Europe. And so a longtime Berlin resident, a Swedish gentleman named Theodore, you know, he didn't have any question about what had happened.
No, we don't know. Of course we don't. But, you know, to say that this was an accident, I would say it's impossible.
Well, that's the view of a longtime Berliner. But what was the range of perspectives as to why this had happened and what's going on?
Well, also there on the scene were three Syrian men who own a restaurant nearby. And they were certain that this could not have been a refugee.
There is a 0% chance that a refugee did this. 0%. They did not do it. We are not refugees, but we have seen how they live, and it's impossible.
Would you say there's tension in Berlin right now, even given the holiday spirit and the fact that life goes on?
Of course. I mean, this is the central political issue in Germany right now. And you can see from reactions of different politicians and from different newspapers that some people are saying we have to continue forward and celebrating because to live in fear is to lose. Whereas others, you know, a particular politician from the far right party, the AfD, tweeted that, you know, when will the hypocrisy end? These people who died are, you know, Angela Merkel's dead. So there's a huge spectrum of, you know, frustration that this is the situation that Germany finds itself in right now.
Is Merkel reassuring people on the ground?
She is saying that she feels, you know, deep sadness, and that specifically it would be sickening, I think was the word that she used, if the person who perpetrated this turned out to be someone who had applied for protection in Germany.
And that sadness you found right down there by that Kaiser Wilhelm Church, which remains a memorial to the vast history of Berlin in the 20th century.
That's right. Just on the other side of the market, I saw a group of women by one of the police lines, and I approached them, and they were actually members of a choir that sings in the church, and their rehearsal had been interrupted by the attack. Police came in and asked them to leave. And so I asked them a little bit to tell me about like what was so important about this place specifically for Berliners.
This is a memorial against the war. It is for freedom and peace, and now it's
and many tourists come here.
Any special security curfews in place at this point, or is just the investigation continues, Thalia?
The investigation continues. That particular Christmas market remains closed out of respect for what happened, but the mayor and other politicians have urged other Christmas markets to stay open.
Thalia Beatty is a freelance print and radio journalist in Berlin, also a former Takeaway producer. Thalia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
What happens when a criminal defendant's case gets lost in the ruthless office politics among local and state judges? In this week's Case in Point, profile of the criminal justice system in the United States, a 30-year sentence and years of futile attempts to clear his name was the result. Clifton Duane Harvin was charged in the 1990s with sexually abusing his young daughter, a charge he's consistently denied with the support of polygraph tests. But acting on the advice of his then-lawyer, Harvin pleaded no contest in exchange for a 10-year probationary sentence and the promise he thought that he'd be able to retroactively prove his innocence. While on probation, Harvin was found in possession of a controlled substance, though, and the court revoked his probation and sentenced him to 60 years in a Texas prison for the underlying crime, which he continued to deny. Finally, in 2010, his daughter, known only as A.H. in court documents, swore under oath that her father was innocent. Yet Harvin remains behind bars in Texas. Andrew Cohen is the author of the Marshall Project's Case in Point series. Lillian Hardwick is an attorney and co-author of the Handbook of Texas Lawyer and Judicial Ethics. Hardwick says this was a case of bad advice meeting even worse judicial conduct.
He thought he could basically prove his innocence down the road. That seemed to have fallen on deaf ears as he tried to do that later on. Even though nobody truly disputed that, and even though there wasn't anything in the court record to dispute that.
So, we normally think of there's a trial court, and then there's an appellate court, and then there's maybe a Supreme Court. You know, in this particular case, he thought that he was going to find a judge that would undo his deal. And instead, Andrew, as you tell the story, he was getting himself more twisted into a situation that would result in his incarceration essentially for life.
That's right. And one of the other sort of components here that's so striking is the level of conflicts that were involved. The first attorney he went to said, sure, I'll take your case. And it was basically they were going to go down to the police station and do a polygraph. And by the way, Harvin, the defendant here, passed 3 polygraph tests. So he arranges with this lawyer to take the polygraph test. The lawyer doesn't show up. He doesn't take the test. Turns out the lawyer, the defense attorney, becomes his prosecutor in the same case. That evidently is not a conflict enough to warrant some sort of a new trial. Then at another point, he gets the other lawyer. This is the lawyer who tells him to take the plea deal. That lawyer later was disbarred. On top of sort of the procedural stuff going on, you have these conflicts that all of the courts are recognizing, but then they're at the same time saying these conflicts aren't enough for us to do any justice to this man.
Lillian Hardwick, clearly there were attorney failures here, but how did that translate or work its way up the chain to involve judges?
Mr. Harvin's very first lawyer became the judge of that court. So that was error number one. Error number two was a lawyer that he actually encountered out in the hallway of the court who volunteered to represent him for a sum of money when reportedly the trial judge would not appoint Mr. Harvin a lawyer. This lawyer had problems with effective assistance, and although that was not clearly determined in the case of Mr. Harvin, it may be that there were some disciplinary issues with regard to him. But the fact is that lawyer was ultimately disbarred for ineffectively assisting individuals in other types of cases. His third lawyer, he was determined to have provided ineffective assistance of counsel on the appellate level. So you keep hoping that some successor lawyer will do what the other one has not done, that is, do his job for the client.
Now, this is an unusual case, Andrew, and we should stipulate that. But the window that it opens here is that when you get to the appellate level and there are attorneys who have made mistakes, the defendant can get lost as the judges sort of clean up their own messes here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Too often, appellate judges excuse the shoddy work of lawyers. And too often, I think appellate judges excuse the shoddy work of lower court judges. Over and over again, these appellate judges went back to these lower court judges and said, you're not justifying your rationale enough. You're not answering the questions we have, basic questions about the case. You need to do a better job. In the end, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the highest court, essentially gave up and said, all right, we've had enough justification. We're comfortable with this 60-year sentence for this man, but it's not the way it's supposed to work. Usually in cases of injustice that we talk about in America, there's some sort of abuse of the process. Here, the whole process itself was turned on its head in a way that I think results in an injustice.
What do you think will be the final outcome here, and what's the prescription for court systems around the country?
Here's what I think should happen. And first of all, I mean, you can say, yeah, there was a problem with the judge at the trial level and probably even the prosecutor at that level. And so your check and balance on that is that when it gets sent back down, let it go to a different judge. Well, magically, that actually happened here because the trial judge and the prosecutor were smart enough to distance themselves from this case. And they said, well, this ought to be assigned to somebody else. We shouldn't have anything to do with it, which was exactly the right analysis. And I was very hopeful because it was assigned to a senior judge. And I thought, well, gee, why is this judge dragging his feet when the Court of Criminal Appeals has three times asked him to do something? It didn't make sense until I realized that he actually retired from the bench in 2004. So he was sitting by assignment. In some sense, you could view that as favor from the administrative judge of that particular region when this case was coming back to him, actually asking him to make findings that might reflect negatively on the first judge. So my hope is that if this case somehow gets to a position where Mr. Harvin can have his error-free day in court, and I'm quoting from Justice Meyer's dissent in saying that, I hope that it's in a totally different administrative judicial region outside of the triad counties of Montague, Clay, and Archer.
An error-free day in court. That's all this defendant wants, right, Andrew?
That's right. And the other thing to say, maybe the final thing to say, is Justice Lawrence Myers wrote this stinging dissent and said, you know, we're the same court that gave relief to Governor Rick Perry when he was a defendant. We were the same court that gave relief to Tom DeLay when he was a defendant. We sort of contorted ourselves and our jurisprudence to give relief, and yet we can't find a way to give this man the relief that he's asking for because he's not politically connected. It was a very powerful dissent, and what happened to Justice Myers, he was voted out of office last month. He was up for retention, and he was voted out, so he's no longer going to be on the bench if and when this case comes back around.
Andrew and Lillian, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're welcome.
Andrew Cohen is commentary editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. Lillian Hardwick is an attorney and co-author of The Handbook of Texas Lawyer and Judicial Ethics.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
In Flint, Michigan, residents would love to simply get their clean water restored. Residents are still living without clean drinking water 2 years after officials identified dangerous levels of lead in tap water around the city, lead and other chemicals. Today, the Michigan Attorney General brought criminal charges against four more city and state officials. Quinn Kleinfelter is senior news editor for WDET in Detroit, and he joins me now. Quinn, who's being charged?
Well, a couple of people that were right near the top of this. The information that the Attorney General provided is that they are filing, or rather he is filing charges against the former Flint emergency managers, Darnell Early and Gerald Ambrose, and another city official, Howard Croft. He was the public works superintendent at the time that the city started using Flint water. And also an administrator for the utilities, Dougherty Johnson. This is big because the emergency managers are the ones that were put in by the state of Michigan, specifically by the governor, Rick Snyder, to try to straighten out the finances of Flint, which in many ways has led to this water crisis. And so they're actually targeting people that they're saying did this knowingly, that they were going to hurt the public by their actions.
So this is charging them for criminal offenses, for basically trying to deal with the financial catastrophe in Flint by creating another catastrophe.
Yeah, very much so. You know, they face felony charges of what's called false pretenses and conspiracy to commit false pretenses. And this is not a joke. These are 20-year felonies apiece. And they're saying that they knew that the water was likely to hurt people, but that they went ahead and went forward with the plan to switch from the Detroit River to the Flint River. It's been such a while now that people have talked about this crisis. They kind of lose track that this was only supposed to be a very temporary switch, only to the river for a year or two until they hooked up to a new system so that they could try to save money. That was ostensibly the reason. And, you know, it seems at times as if the state officials hoped that they could just get through this year period without any problems, and apparently didn't realize without treating the water the way that they were supposed to, that there would be some kind of health issues. Now, with what the Attorney General is saying, is that they were aware there could be health issues, and when they were ordered to reconnect to the Detroit water system, which might have been a bit more costly, but again, would have saved it health-wise, that they refrained from doing so.
What is the state of the new water system that might, we would think, in theory, correct Flint's problems for good?
It is taking a while to get put in place. There's thousands and thousands of water lines that would have lead in them. And that, again, is the crux of the issue. When they actually made the first switch, you put in a chemical along with this new water supply, and that would have eliminated the possibility of the lead contamination, and the state did not do that purposely. At the same time, the state was fighting an order from a judge to deliver bottled water to residents in Flint who are still having to use a filter in order to try to drink anything. The judge said, you know, you should deliver X amount of cases every week to individual households, and the state said that would cost tens of millions of dollars. It's just we can't do it. They can come get bottled water themselves if they want. And an appeals court has just recently said, no, you should deliver those bottles of water. So, yeah, and, you know, what seems to have been a case of trying to save money on behalf of the state of Michigan is costing it way more in terms of both money and potential jail time.
And the Environmental Protection Agency could have advised them on exactly what chemical they could have put into the water to prevent the lead from leaching off of the pipes. They heard that recommendation and ignored it, or they never heard it?
I actually talked to the regional director, the regional administrator for Region 5, which governs Detroit, Chicago, et cetera. And I spoke with her about that at the time. She is no longer there and resigned. And she said that there is this lead and copper rule where if you meet certain criteria by checking the water at certain periods of the time, it's all okay. And the state said that they did that, but it was the bare minimum. They've pointed fingers at each other ever since, the state and the EPA, and said, oh, you should have realized you should have done more. Neither did, and the populace of Flint's been the one that suffered.
And all these issues are likely to come up in court in these new charges against four more city and state officials. Quinn Kleinfelter, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Quinn Kleinfelter is senior news editor for WDET in Detroit. A period of stability, freedom, and prosperity may have come to an end in the Eastern European nation of Poland with a constitutional crisis. Over the weekend, major protests both inside and outside the Polish government are in response to an announcement by the ruling Law and Justice Party that it will soon begin restricting the news media's access to the Polish parliament. The populist right-wing government wants only those journalists with special accreditation to be allowed into the parliament, but government critics complain that the proposed new rules are part of an ongoing effort by the ruling party to consolidate its powers. Adam Easton is the BBC's correspondent in Warsaw, Poland. Adam, is this a sort of circling of the wagons in Warsaw?
This is the latest in a string of protests against the governing Law and Justice Party, which is a sort of nationalist-leaning party, somewhat populist party, conservative, very much supports traditional Roman Catholic values. And we've had in monthly demonstrations since the party took office last November, just over a year ago. And this is the latest one. And this was sparked by a plan by the governing party to severely restrict journalists' access to MPs in parliament, to lawmakers in parliament. And for the last 27 years, since the collapse of communism, journalists here in Poland have had pretty unrestricted access. They can mingle in the corridors with MPs, ask searching questions, and pretty much do what they want, apart from go into the main parliament plenary hall. They've got obviously a gallery to watch from up there. So all but a handful, just two accredited journalists per media outlet, would be allowed into the parliament under the plan. The rest, several hundred, would have to watch parliamentary sessions in a separate building, some way away from parliament building, on TV screens or on their computers, and they'd have to wait for MPs to come over to brief them. Now, journalists and opposition parties said this is a breach of the constitutional right to freedom, access to information. This is in the constitution. Journalists should be able to have free access to parliamentary sessions. And this is what caused this 4 days of street protests, not just in Warsaw, the capital, but across the country. And in fact, I've just come from outside the parliament building, and there's still protests going on there now, despite obviously the freezing temperatures we've got here.
Adam, would you say that people are concerned that this is a return to the Cold War period in Poland, and that the government would behave in that way? Or is this something that the Law and Justice Party is doing on its own, is in its own style?
I would say that there are certain sort of perhaps more liberal-minded Poles who are concerned about Law and Justice's commitment to traditional democratic values. And as I say, we've had a number of issues, including the neutering of the country's top court, the Constitutional Court, which can veto government legislation. Now, the governing party introduced a series of changes over the last year, and it's still doing so, which has effectively paralyzed the work of the court. So the court has been unable to veto government legislation, and in fact, the governing party has just ignored its rulings because it didn't have it only had a minority of its judges on that court when it took office. So that is something that has seriously concerned people here, not just the people in Poland, of course, because the European Union is starting an unprecedented investigation into a serious breach of the rule of law in Poland because of that issue. But there are other issues like taking over, taking control of the public media. And, you know, more liberal-minded Poles would say this is now government propaganda. There are other issues such as politicizing the civil service, taking over political control of the prosecution service. Now, some people say this is a return to the communist days. Now, that would be an exaggeration, in my opinion. But there are certainly more than grounds for concern about the governing party's commitment to traditional democratic values in the West.
And nothing that's going to be likely resolved until well into the new year as the protests continue. Adam Easton is a BBC correspondent in Warsaw, Poland. He spoke to us from Warsaw. Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now a peek inside a glittery holiday package. Kunal Sood grew up in India and has lived all over the world, but he's now living and working in the United States on an F1 student visa. He dreams of becoming a citizen, but right now, they're only dreams.
The only place I call home is America. You know, and my dad gets emotional sometimes when I say this, because the truth is I'd give my life for this country. hands down, no matter what.
Kunal lives here in New York City. He must pass checkpoints and be wary of armed guards as he comes and goes. But this is no high-security holding facility for vetting refugees where he lives. It's Midtown Manhattan, a glittery military green zone on Fifth Avenue with makeshift blast barricades and Secret Service checkpoints, searching people going in and out. But Kunal Sood is waved in and out without a problem. He's been a resident living in Trump Tower since before his landlord decided to also become president of the United States. Kunal's uncertain visa status, coupled with the anti-immigrant rhetoric of the campaign, has stirred up this humble young man. He worries these days that his visa application is in some turmoil, just as he's heard it might be the case for lots of other people under a radically changed immigration policy with a Donald Trump administration. Sood says watching this 2016 campaign, both as an immigrant and as the neighbor of the unlikely but ultimately successful candidate, has challenged his ideas of what America really is.
I felt a lot of it was founded on the fear of identity. I feel we're divided right now on that situation. I'm more inclusive. So I believe that the most beautiful thing about this country is it gives everyone a fair shot, you know, a true shot at life. You won't get that in India, not the way you do in the United States. I'm hoping that that stays true to the core of the United States of America, how, you know, we are truly a democracy.
You explain if you felt at certain points during the campaign that you felt that was really at stake.
Well, I didn't really feel scared per se, to be honest with you. But then when I saw all of the surrounding rhetoric start, then it started to worry me around what could this become? You know, it could really evolve into something much more than just immigration. It could become something that becomes more of a problem of us versus them. And I think the one thing that Trump did very well is he was very certain and solid about his position. So his loyalists appreciated that about him. I feel like, you know, when it comes to the election, what I felt was the worst thing you can be is irrelevant and a bystander in the election. It's kind of like sending in a surrogate to fight for you. This was both sides playing games. And obviously, in the end, Trump won the election. So,
did you believe he was capable of this kind of campaigning?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I actually really thought he was going to win. From the beginning.
From the beginning. We're talking summer of 2015.
When he said the American dream was dead is when I thought he had a chance of winning. Because he spoke to the hearts of a lot of the people in the mainland. He had a certainty around everything he said. And he wouldn't back down. And when that quality is in a leader, somehow, for good or for better or for worse, it's a very powerful trait.
Do you ever feel like, you know, you're a fly on the wall to amazing events?
Yeah, I don't hate the guy, which is interesting.
He's your neighbor.
I know. No, but I never hated him because I kind of knew part of his family, right, growing up. I mean, in my early days as an apprentice. And I can tell you, I don't know him personally, except I've met him a couple of times, but I know his daughter is an amazing human being.
So how long have you been living in the Trump Tower?
I haven't been living that long. I've only been there for a year. But
what was it like over this year as the campaign went on and you're in the Trump Tower and you realize that you're essentially living at a kind of ground zero?
If Trump runs the country, anything like he runs his home, which is the Trump Tower, we're in very good shape. I can say that, you know, I can actually say that with a lot of confidence. Now, it's not the same as running a country, but I definitely don't think Trump, he himself has pledged a lot of allegiance and affection for India, per se, especially if we're good people. Hopefully we're good people coming in. So I'm not worried about that. I'm just worried about the inflammatory rhetoric, which doesn't really involve me, but does involve people in my country.
You're a storyteller.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, I think you have a sort of an interesting view of things like this. Do you think that these circumstances of your life, that what you've been permitted to see, the fact that you're this fly on the wall in Trump Tower in the middle of this most disruptive election at this most extraordinary time in American democracy, what's the lesson? What's it all for? What are you supposed to see and take from this?
Well, you know, this is a very good question because I've been wrestling with this, and I feel it's time to reimagine the pursuit of happiness in this country. I feel like, you know, and I'm guilty as charged, being an Indian. I too came here to find individual happiness, find my identity, and I did. You know, I got very lucky, and I've had the blessing of finding happiness in its most achievement, goal-oriented sense.
Individual sense.
Yeah. So I feel that we have to come together. We have to unite in action. And I really believe that we need to form a super organism now more than ever before.
What if you were stuck in the elevator with Donald Trump for like 6 hours? What would you tell him? What would you advise him? What hope would you try to plant in him?
If I was stuck in an elevator with Donald Trump for 6 hours, I would ask him a lot of questions to learn first and foremost what really gets him excited. And then I would honestly start to navigate that conversation into what I feel is most important for our future. And look, it's a gamble, right? It's a conversation for 6 hours. So, you know, you're right. We could change the face of the earth sometimes with just one conversation. But the truth is, with someone like Donald Trump and someone like me who's a fly on the wall, I'm not sure if my conversation with him is going to make a difference. But if it did, I would sincerely ask him to look at things like climate change, the fact that, you know, we are all in this together. And I mean, recently he started saying that, you know, he started saying that we're all in this together when he's become president. So I hope he lives up to that promise and that he's made, that we're all in this together, because we have to be. If we aren't, we're all in trouble.
Kunal, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kunal Sood is a TED speaker and resident, founder of the X Fellows and Novus, a social impact summit in the United States on a temporary visa. He's a resident of Trump Tower. Continue the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.